This week on Your Western Context, Canada signs a new NAFTA deal. A five-month forestry strike leaves BC communities in limbo, and a Greenpeace video shown in Alberta classrooms sparks a social media firestorm. Also, Andrew Scheer's resignation as leader prompts crazy theories from the media. This is Western Context, episode 148, recorded Friday, December 13th, 2019, The Scheer Departure. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are back as we slowly start to wrap up the year of 2019, move on towards Christmas, and of course we'll have all the information about our Christmas schedule on next week's podcast, but this week we do have a bunch of news to discuss, and oh boy, the media is just having a field day this week, aren't they?
That's for sure, and there's been quite a few big stories that the media could talk about, but certainly none bigger than the one that came out just yesterday morning, which we will, of course, talk about later in the show. But quite a bit that's been going out there on social media that doesn't appear to be actually accurate, and these are coming from otherwise respected journalists. So it's just really another reminder that you really have to look at what you're looking at on Twitter and Facebook and think critically about what's going on out there.
Yeah, and you know, when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, that's what we're here to do. This podcast started in January of 2017, and our goal is to help you, the listeners, remove all the bias and sensationalism that you find in the mainstream media, and along the way, hopefully provide all the information and context necessary to put yourselves on the right side of the news. And we're, in effect, with this first story, circling back to one of the very first chapters of Western Context, and that's the ongoing negotiations between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico regarding a NAFTA replacement deal. And you'll recall that last year there was a deal that was signed, and the U.S. Democrats in the House wouldn't ratify it. Mexico ratified it. It reached second reading in our parliament before parliament was dissolved this past summer. And as a result of this, they went back to the negotiating table. And this week, a new replacement for NAFTA has been signed again. The signing occurred in Mexico City with Chrystia Freeland, our Deputy Prime Minister, Mexican President Andre Manuel Lopez Obrador, and U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer. And with this, the new trade deal will be known as CUSMA in Canada. Trump prefers to call it USMCA. It remains to be seen which one will take effect in the mainstream parlance. But CUSMA stands for Canada-US United States-Mexico Agreement. And before going into effect, this must, of course, be ratified by all three countries, and the Mexican Senate has already agreed to ratify the agreement. So it's just a question of when Nancy Pelosi puts it up in the House and when it arrives to our House of Commons. Now, the bill to ratify NAFTA, as I mentioned, died when Parliament was dissolved this summer. It was at second reading, and we were wondering at this point what that would mean, because at that point in time, it was really in the court of the U.S. Democrats and Nancy Pelosi as they held up NAFTA this summer and fall and even earlier this year, choosing instead to focus on investigations and the ultimate impeachment of the U.S. president, as that vote is going to be happening very soon. The U.S. Democrats also brought in additional changes to the agreement that modified the dispute settlement mechanism, labor protections primarily for Mexican workers, environmental protections were also looked at, intellectual property protections too, which is very important in the modern era, as there are many focuses of trade that look at countries that have a somewhat shady trading practice. In this case, we're talking about China, where they will just steal intellectual property. And what this does is puts the entire North American trade deal on a ledge above everyone else, ensuring that anything that is patented and built or invented in North America will be protected. There's also going to be rule of origin rules for car production. So what this means is that 70% of aluminum produced in all of the cars in North America must come from NAFTA countries. And with this is important for Quebec, because Quebec is going to be the primary aluminum producer within the NAFTA trading agreement. So with this, 70% of every car that uses aluminum must come from these NAFTA countries. Now, we also need to look at what else this does for vehicles, because 40% of vehicles would also have to originate in places where workers earn at least $16 US per hour. Now, you're probably wondering, why is this important? Because here in Canada, most places have a minimum wage of $15 an hour or slightly less, and in the US, it can be at that ballpark marker as well. But this is important because wages are much, much cheaper in Mexico. And this delves into what this agreement really does and why we need to look at this agreement as the blueprint for trade deals going forward, and why there should be questions asked when you're looking at trade deals like the Trans-Pacific Partnership or potential deals with China. And that comes down to free trade versus fair trade. You can have free trade where there are absolutely no tariffs on the trade goods flowing back and forth between the countries, or you can have fair trade where there are no tariffs, but each country is treated as it deserves to be treated, and this is the case with Mexico because their wages are lower. This ensures that an automaker such as Ford can't just ship the jobs to make their cars over to Mexico for cheaper value, and that's what this does with the $16 US per hour ballpark mark on car production. It ensures that any car made in North America will be produced at this value, so people can have confidence in the fact that their cars are not being produced for cheap in Mexico, and Mexico is being taken advantage of, and the companies are getting off scot-free. It's an equal partnership between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. The U.S. also gets a deal on prescription drugs. Previously, biologic drugs, which are drugs that are made from living cells, were protected from competition for 10 years. And the benefit of this deal to both Canada and Mexico is made clear by just how much the U.S. doesn't rely on its NAFTA trading partners. The new deal will add about $68 billion worth of trade into the U.S. and generate 176,000 new jobs in the U.S. over 6 years only. Only 6 years. So when you extend that out on a per-year basis, it's really not that much. Now, compare this to the fact that the U.S. on its own has an economy that's worth $22 trillion. So NAFTA is a drop in the bucket for the U.S. We've long said that it was Canada and secondly Mexico that benefited from this and needed this deal, but for ultimately different reasons. Then we get to what the media didn't talk about with this, which was absolutely astounding because you think they would. And that's the U.S. President Donald Trump. This trade deal was one of his signature campaign promises to renegotiate or get the U.S. out of NAFTA. The U.S. media and Democrats have been engineering the case for impeachment since 10 minutes after Donald Trump took the oath of office back in January of 2017, and Trump's approval within his own party is the highest that any president has seen in recent memory. He's also within striking distance or leading Democratic challengers in the key states of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. This deal is more than providing certainty for Canada. It provides the U.S. president with a win that is ultimately handed to him by Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats while they were trying to impeach him. And just look at the optics of that. The Democrats handing the president a win, a person that, by all accounts, if you read the media, they hate. Now, Joe Biden also factors into this because many see him as the front runner in the U.S. Democratic race, but Joe Biden was a huge fan of NAFTA back in the day, and this provides Trump with the biggest bat possible to hit Biden with should he become the Democratic nominee. The worst part about this for Biden, Canada likes a deal, Mexico likes a deal, the Democrats now like the deal, and we wouldn't be in this position without Nancy Pelosi. The Canadian media would ultimately be wise to remember this, that given their constant coverage of the U.S. administration, this deal changes the conversation in the U.S. more than anywhere else. And we have to ask the question, did we see this anywhere this week? And we didn't. And that's why this is in our show.
Yeah, exactly. It came out earlier this week, and within almost half a day of it being brought out, it was almost collectively forgotten about in the media memory. And we didn't see anything about this, didn't see anyone talking about it whatsoever. And this is a big deal for Canada because it has a huge impact on how our economy goes is going forward, and especially for our resource industries, but also automobiles in Ontario. Also, it has a lot of the economics going back and forth between Quebec and the states. It impacts the whole entire country, and the fact that the media ignored this is a huge story was quite surprising to see.
Yeah, and you know, this is going to be a deal that ensures that our economy doesn't have any major shocks to it. And for all intents and purposes, as we covered previously, this is a deal that is more of a tweak than anything. It's not going to change major calculations here in Canada for it. And the main reason we wanted to get this deal done was not to have a shock of having NAFTA taken away. That would have caused untold consequences for the Canadian economy. And people are happy about that. But I think, as we mentioned here and as the media missed, most of the focus on this is going to be in the U.S. because this is a hallmark achievement for the U.S. president amongst anyone else. And the media is not really talking about that, but that's what it is, because this deal helps Canada, but it doesn't really change our trading relationship in the wholesale way that it's changing in the U.S.
And in a sense, that's a good thing, because after the news came out last week that over 71,000 jobs were lost in the month of November alone, having a huge shock to the economy or having huge widespread changes happening to it would be a bit of a problem, especially given the state of the Canadian economy right now, where the government and Stats Canada is trying to tell us that it's going along just fine, but then numbers come out just after the election in October that suggest that it's actually not going fine. And certainly there's a lot of issues with that going forward in Canada, but the media doesn't really seem to be talking about it very much, and that's why I think it was one of our big stories this week.
Yeah, and we'll have to watch and see if there's any other bumps in the road with this, because as we all know, we do live in turbulent times. We have minority government here. Democrats control the House, whereas there's a Republican president, so I'll have to wait and see what comes from that. But everyone is hopeful that this deal will be ratified this time. All right, so moving on into BC, what do we got this week?
Well, it's been about 2.5 years since the BC NDP took power, and by and large, lots of people seem to be generally happy with the work that's been done by Premier John Horgan, and his approval rating remains among the top premiers, and sporadic polls since then have suggested that the NDP still hold a very slim lead over the BC Liberals. But in some parts of the province, not all is rosy. Outside of the Lower Mainland, which incidentally happens to hold most of the NDP seats, small communities are very much relying on natural resources, which is a very main difference between the Lower Mainland and the rest of BC. And natural resources, of course, is one of the black marks on Horgan's record as premier. And while much of the publicity of the last few years for natural resources in BC has been on Horgan attempting to stall the Trans Mountain pipeline expansion by any means possible, little has actually been said about the NDP government's covert hostility to our forestry sector. Now, since May of this year, dozens of companies have been curtailing sawmill operations, cutting shifts, or even outright closing hundreds of mills and logging operations in areas that desperately need them to keep their community's economy going. And we've detailed that a few times on the podcast in a few episodes here and there since the summer. And there's one that we haven't talked about yet, and that's on northern Vancouver Island, where the communities are few and far between, and their dependence on resources can threaten entire towns if companies stop work. And one of the stoppages there is actually due to a 5-month strike at Western Forest Products, or otherwise known as WFP, which has left companies, contractors, and communities themselves on northern Vancouver Island caught in the middle of an economic crisis. Now, the 5-month strike at 6 Western Forest Product manufacturing plants and Timberlands locations involves roughly 3,000 members of the United Steelworkers local union. But the ripple effect in small island communities that depend on forestry for their economic livelihood has been much larger, as contractors, suppliers, even local businesses and municipalities outside of the two deadlock parties, that being Western Forest Product Management as well as the union, they're going to be suffering as well. And Tamara Meggett, who co-runs a Loonies for Loggers group that is soliciting donations, food, and Christmas hampers for those affected by the strike, says that she estimates up to 10,000, even up to 15,000 people are directly impacted by the strike. And she says that there's an aura of desperation around the strikers, saying that lots of them are breaking down. Some of them are having been threatened to lose their home or their vehicles, and some people have lost their insurance. It's a bad state, and it's not very good at all in a lot of these small towns that very much rely on forestry. Now, in the 2,200-person home of Port McNeil, which relies almost entirely on the forestry sector, Mayor Gabby Wickstrom said that community groups, churches, and families are organizing group dinners and other support services for those affected. Premier John Horgan has characterized the dispute as a private sector matter, but after 5 months with communities in crisis, Mayor Wickstrom said that governments can no longer sit on the sidelines. She said, quote, "You can't tell me they don't need help and you have to let the process run its course. How long are we going to wait? We're resilient and we're going to pick up the pieces, but the longer this drags on, the longer it will take to pick up those pieces, and it will take us a hell of a long time to get back." Now, government set up a $69 million forestry aid package in September, but only interior forest workers are eligible for most of the money. And North Island MLA and Transportation Minister Claire Trevena was harshly criticized in a forestry town hall meeting last week for her government's inaction to help coastal forestry workers during a time of crisis. Now, Trevena received an uncomfortable reminder last week of the gulf between the political bubble of the legislature in Victoria and the rest of the real world after she was blasted by forestry workers in her North Island riding during that town hall. The meeting was in Campbell River, in which more than 50 people gathered to vent their frustration at the inaction of her government to mitigate the forestry crisis. The gathering was many months in the making, she explained, because she'd been busy at the Capitol doing the work of minister. Now, a 30-minute video of the encounter showed the genuine anger and, in some cases, desperation being experienced by mill workers, contractors, employers, truck loggers, and the striking WFP employees as they shared stories of losing their livelihoods, families, and home. And the raw emotion caught Trevena and indeed the New Democrats by surprise, because the New Democrats have skated through the fall session of the legislature by avoiding the forestry crisis as much as it could. And there's been no legislation, regulations, or significant announcements to help the more than 3,000 people who've lost their jobs or have had their shifts curtailed before Christmas, and there's been no intervention to speed a resolution to the 5-month Western Forest Products strike. Now, Eric Dutchevich, who is the president and CEO of the Lemaire Group in Port McNeil, which is the largest forestry services provider on the North Island, he says that it's, quote, absolutely decimated the forestry side of their business. And he said the same can be said for dozens and dozens of dedicated contractors to WFP. Now, Lemaire, which conducts phase contracting, specialty road construction, and dryland sorting for WFP, employs 200 members of the United Steelworkers Union. But he says that he's not actually allowed to negotiate with them directly. Instead, he's been forced to watch while his cost to the company has been $47 million in lost wages, goods and services, taxation, and stumpage fees. Now, opposition Liberal critic John Rustad, who is a former forestry minister himself, said that he's visited the North Island and heard some of the stories directly. He said, quote, "I talked to a car dealer in the previous week or two, and he had to repossess 10 vehicles, and he said, 'You got all the stories. It's so tragic to hear and see what's happening. One guy came in and begged and pleaded that he wanted to keep his vehicle through Christmas, so they ended up doing a deal with the guy, and he gave them a load of firewood so that he could keep his vehicle for Christmas. And when you think about it, just the real human stories that are coming out of it are just so sad to hear about. And Rustad says that he believes the NDP was slow to act because the United Steelworkers, which of course is the NDP's largest donor in the 2017 election campaign, had asked the government to stay out of the dispute. And he says, quote, "This government has made it very clear, and I've heard this on numerous occasions, that they've got the unions back and they aren't going to do anything unless the union wants them to. And who is left advocating for the people caught by this by no fault of their own?" Now, as we mentioned, the sum total of the NDP's entire response to the forestry crisis was that effort 3 months ago with its $69 million forestry aid package. But unfortunately, that just has to deal with displaced interior BC forestry workers, and in many cases, it left out the coastal sector, and that didn't offer a single new dollar of aid during the collapse of an industry that used to be the economic lifeblood of that part of the province. And then, of course, there's the NDP forestry policies that the industry has blamed for exacerbating the financial crisis, including refusing to intervene on stumpage rates, adding fees onto raw log exports, new penalties if wood waste isn't brought out of the bush, and a coastal revitalization consultation process that's going nowhere, and a new government veto on Crown timber transfers that won't let companies swap forest license unless the forestry minister personally deems it to be in the public interest. So when it comes down to it, it's easy for the NDP to convince itself it's done enough to help the forestry sector in the legislature, but back in the real world, Claire Trevena, who is one of the few rural NDP MLAs with forestry workers in her riding, was told quite clearly otherwise. One person told Trevena at the town hall, quote, "We've been talking to the government for over a year, and no one's listening to us. You're ramming down new forestry policies that are increasing our costs and making it less economic for us to operate out there. We need forest policy that will help drive costs out of our structure, not drive costs up. That's what we need." And Trevena promised to take their concerns back to Victoria. However, that wasn't good enough for the room. Another worker said, "This can't be news to the government. You can't still be in the information gathering part of this, of solving this problem." Another demanded, "Is there a plan in place?" And Trevena had no answer to this. And one man in the room put his finger on the frustration. He said, "For the working man's party, you haven't seen a lot of work for them." Now, while Trevena was getting grilled, Forestry Minister Doug Donaldson was announcing a halt to logging on the BC side of the Skagit River Valley, which is just south of Hope, BC. And you couldn't ask for a more representative example of the BC NDP in 2019, congratulatory press release about how it's preventing trees from being logged. Now, another man in the meeting room with Trevena sharpened the point. He said, quote, "I think this room is ready to take matters into its own hands. That's how far behind we are. Everybody in here has had differences of opinions, competed against each other for all these years, and they're now coming together, and it's not going to be to help you out if it takes this long." And I think comments like that should give the BCNDP great pause, because party strategists have convinced themselves that the collapse of the forestry sector won't hurt the NDP's re-election chances because it mainly affects people in rural ridings where the NDP has almost no MLAs. But as Trevena's meeting showed, the problem bleeds over into previously safe ridings like North Island, which has been reliable NDP territory for decades. And if the New Democrats are losing riding like that, they have to make it up somewhere else, right? Bob Dewar, who was the NDP's 2017 election campaign guru, tried to warn NDP members of this electoral math when he spoke to the party convention last month, and he bluntly said, quote, "We didn't win the last election," which is quite true, because the NDP with its 41 seats is not a majority government, and it has to pick up at least 4 new seats from the Greens or the Liberals in the next election to have a hope in a majority. And most importantly, it has to hold every single riding it currently has, including the ones affected by the forestry crisis like the North Island. Now, the NDP has been coasting along its belief that it is immune to the forestry crisis and therefore hasn't been expending an ounce of political capital to help fight for the workers and to prop up the sector during its worst crisis in decades. But as the confrontation in Trevena's riding showed, that political calculation may be a mistake that the New Democrats will deeply regret.
And, you know, there were some questions in the federal campaign as to why the Conservatives did so well in BC, specifically rural BC. And, you know, we're seeing it right here. It's natural resources, whether it's wood in BC or oil and gas in Alberta and Saskatchewan. It's a general concern regarding natural resources in this country that is a primary industry that is a good economic driver, but there is bad policy from numerous levels of government that is putting its foot on it. It is as simple as that. Ask anyone who has a basic understanding of economics after looking at any of these policies, and they will tell you that. It's as simple as that. And it's also nice to see that somebody, Bob Dewar, recognized that you don't win minority governments. So, and that's something we've always said here on the podcast as well.
Yeah, exactly. I think we've seen this a lot in the last federal election, where there was just a huge division in parts of the country against the Liberals and for the Conservatives, and it's a lot of the resource areas. The Conservatives did very well in the resource-friendly areas of BC, and certainly a lot of rural BC, and they even encroached into Vancouver, because a lot of those places have a lot to do with the resource industry as well, even though they're closer to the cities. And I think that a lot of it comes down to the fact that on a provincial level, the policies haven't been there, and there hasn't been help for it. And on the federal level, there hasn't been good governance in trying to deal with the United States on things like log exports and the timber exports. And a lot of these mills are closing up shop, and they're heading towards the States just because they can actually do business there. And I think that's something that the Trudeau government has on their hands at this point. They've been in power for just over 4 years now, and they can't complain about the previous government before, because they are now the previous government.
Yeah, and you know, we just finished talking about the NAFTA deal. One thing that was excluded in the original NAFTA rewrite and this NAFTA rewrite is there's no softwood lumber deal that would go on for many years on this. And we're still without a softwood lumber agreement as well. So that's something that would help BC. And it just continues to go on and on and on. And, you know, pointing this out, it's something that affects many provinces. And if the media is wondering what's going on in Western Canada, well, you now have a case in BC that is alarmingly similar to what happened in Alberta, seeing many people lose their jobs and be very upset about that, and rightly so, especially around this time of year. So that's something that the media should take care of, that it's not just Alberta, and it's not because, oh, we're too concerned about moving away from a oil-based economy. It's in a sustainable forestry sector too, as BC has. So good discussion on that. And we're going to move on to Alberta right now, but before we do that, I'll just take a moment to talk about our Patreon page, which you can find at patreon.com/westerncontext. And there we offer three tiers of support if you want to support the podcast. For $2 a month, at the price of a cup of coffee, you can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, at the price of a sandwich, you can continue to help us do that, but you can have your name read out on the show if you want. And for $10 a month, you become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into your work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. When we reach $25 a month in contributions, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month, where we'll reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide our opinion on where things might be going next. And at $50 a month, you can expect online town halls. These will be hosted every quarter. Topics of discussion will include the news of the month, the state of the media, and your questions. We also do have an option to make a one-time contribution via PayPal as well, and you can learn more about that and the Patreon option at westerncontext.ca/support. All right, so our Alberta story this week is one that definitely should have people scratching their heads, and this is something that we see all too often in the modern era. So we're going to back up, and you might not have heard of before a small town called Black Falls, Alberta, and you might be wondering why exactly they are making news. Well, to know a bit about that, we need to know where Black Falls exactly is, and that's north of Red Deer. It's a small town of about 9,000 people. They have a intermediate school there in particular. This week, Iron Ridge Intermediate Campus, there was a lesson going on there in a grade 4 class where the teacher showed two videos in class about the oil sands. One was from the Alberta government and one was from Greenpeace. So I'm sure our listeners can imagine where this is going next. An assignment was given to those grade four students where the students were then asked how Alberta should manage the competing demands of land use for oil development, wind and solar, agriculture, and recreation, amongst other things. The assignment prompted a debate on a closed Facebook group amongst parents, so we can't exactly see what it was, even if it wasn't deleted. The posts went off topic and were ultimately shut down by moderators due to the fact that threats were made and the RCMP had to get involved. Now, the RCMP with this ended up issuing a ticket to the people involved. Yeah, the RCMP issued a ticket over a fight on Facebook under the School Act for disturbing or interrupting the proceedings of a school, which was news to me because I had no idea the RCMP could do that or there was any kind of provision in place protecting schools like that. A second post was made not even 48 hours after the first had been taken down, and the school had to make some decisions on this, so much so that they wound up hosting a social media information session this Tuesday, but not before the school's Christmas dance was canceled for fear out of parents confronting the teacher at the dance. Now, the school wrote, as you are aware, this week, we were forced to cancel the annual Iron Ridge Intermediate Campus Family School Christmas Dance. Please know that this was not an easy decision, as we know the excitement students and families have for this event and the value it carries for the school. But through events that unfolded throughout the week, the safety of students and staff at the event became uncertain, forcing us to make that ultimate decision. Now, this is the point here where we'd like to have a look and see what exactly the posts look like. But first, it was in a private Facebook group and they have been deleted and there are no screenshots of it. So we can't verify the veracity of these posts to see just how threatening they were. Now, the school did end up holding that social media information session on December 10th for the parents involved. Now, Joe Whitbread, who is the co-founder of Joe Social Media Incorporated, hosted the session. He said that it's ultimately due to an online divisive culture where both sides want to be right and there's no compassion or empathy. It's a fight, not a debate. And, you know, this story was initially in the Globe and Mail, and for those who look at the way the media reported the Alberta election this year, it should be no surprise. We've seen this many times in the Alberta election and the federal election. Social media like this, these debates or fights as they actually are, run election campaigns, the Twitter election as it was called. It was also said that a school principal sat in on the lesson and, in their opinion, the teacher was leading the class properly, presenting both sides of the argument. But this should be the end of the discussion on this, right? But it's not, because the Globe and Mail this week painted it as though that the UCP, the government, was aiming to weaponize the classroom in one way or another, in their view, being pro-oil development. They did this, citing the premier's idea that the NDP was previously attempting to, quote, smuggle in left-wing politics into the education curriculum and that Education Minister Adrienne LaGrange promised to, quote, get politics out of the classroom. Now, the reality of this is as followed. Number one, the school could have chose a better group than Greenpeace because, quite frankly, Greenpeace at times has bordered an environmental terrorist group. They're known as causing disruption, getting arrested, scaling buildings, defacing public property, and I could go on. So the school could have chose a better group to articulate the side that showcased a green economy rather than an energy economy. Number two, this is a social media squabble, proving once again how the mainstream media in this country can be led around with a carrot on a stick, that carrot, of course, being social media. Number three, parents have every right to know what's being taught in their child's classroom. They can have opinions on it. They can share those opinions with teachers. And they need to ensure that it doesn't encroach on what is the primary economic driver of our province, which many people would like to say that we're moving away from that. But the reality is that many people in Alberta do indeed support the oil industry, and many teachers are a part of the Alberta Teachers Association, which is a group that supports the NDP. Now, there's one final note on this week. The Canadian Energy Center was launched. This is the Energy War Room, as it was called during the election campaign, that has the goal of countering bad media, foreign attacks, and the anti-energy lobby. Their website can be found at CanadianEnergyCenter.ca. They have a collection of articles up right now about how energy is extracted in Canada, how we can fight climate change with Canadian energy, and as well as a slick ad showing what reclamation and conservation looks like in the energy sector up north here in Alberta.
I think this whole story here is just it's just a crazy story that came about, and just goes to show that the power that social media can have, and the fact that the school had to cancel the Christmas dance, and that they were holding a social media information session talking about that. It just shows just how news has changed in our day and age, and how in 2019 social media has gained even more of a foothold in our lives, and how it can totally influence the mainstream media. And of course, the fact of the story that the teacher was trying to choose Greenpeace as a counterexample to the government of Alberta just goes to show that there's a lot of misinformation out there about the natural resources in our country, and even in Alberta, where there should be a lot of support for it. And that's something that was definitely baffling to read about this week.
Yeah, and you know, you don't get much more than the heartland of the Alberta Conservative movement than rural Alberta, just north of Red Deer. Maybe a bit in the southern province, but those two areas are pretty much tied for that in terms of how much those folks there follow the Conservative Party. And, you know, the Canadian Energy Center, you would think that it is a government media operation, but everything there is thoroughly researched, cited, and with that, it doesn't carry on as propaganda as many in the media and the NDP would like to think. Everything there is thoroughly researched. And, you know, that was going to be the main story this week here in our Alberta segment until this broke. So I would encourage everybody to go to CanadianEnergyCenter.ca and have a look. And if you want to just get there quickly, that's in our full show notes at WesternContext.ca. Okay. Time for our firing line, which is something that came up yesterday and the media are having their field day with.
That's for sure, and that is the fact that Conservative leader Andrew Scheer is resigning as leader, but he says he will stay on as leader until his replacement is chosen, and he will continue to serve as MP for his Saskatchewan riding of Regina Capel. Now, there's been a lot of speculation out in the media, and, you know, as we at Western Context have done for almost 3 years now, we've been trying to wade through it all and to try and figure out exactly what the reasons were. And there's been a lot of speculation throwing around and a lot of unconfirmed rumors. And as I said just a few moments ago, this is how our social media is. And a lot of people are on social media, and it's hard to know exactly what is true and what isn't when things are broken down into a very small number of words. And there's been news from Mercedes Stevenson of Global News that Andrew Scheer's resignation comes as a direct result of new revelations that he was using Conservative Party money to pay for his children's private schooling, according to Conservative sources who spoke with Global News. But it doesn't come down to that, because it wasn't actually Conservative Party money. It was part of the Conservative Fund, which is the money that the party uses to help keep its operations running. So it's not actually the party itself, it's the fund, which is run by a board of governors and a chair, and there's a whole different brain trust that goes along with it. Now, they are linked, but it's not the same thing. And it just goes to show that even the official media on this can't get the right story. Now, on Twitter, Stevenson said that members of the Conservative Fund say that the expenditures were made without the knowledge or approval of the Conservative Fund itself. And just today, as of recording, Stevenson put out a tweet saying that the executive director of the Conservative Party Dustin Van Vugt has been fired in the wake of the sheer private school expense controversy, and the party has launched an internal review with an auditor. But minutes later, she replied with a tweet that said, quote, "Senior conservative source just called me denying Van Vugt had been fired. Source says as of 3 minutes ago, Van Vugt has not been resigned or terminated. Says that the conservative fund slash party doesn't have the power to fire Van Vugt." And then she then followed up with this, this confusing array of messages that she put out with, quote, "Welcome to the conservative civil war." And this is the problem with social media and journalism. Context is lost. People are guilty before innocent, and fake news can spread so quickly. And right now, there's so many theories out there as to why Scheer resigned that it's hard to tell exactly why. And we don't actually know for sure if this private school spending controversy was actually the case. And we don't know if that's true or not, and I'm leaning towards it not being true, to be honest with you, because it just doesn't make sense that it would happen right away like this and that the global news would find out about this, but no one else, and no one else seems to have any record, and that the Conservative Party itself is denying the allegations. Now, officially, Andrew Scheer says that he is stepping away from being leader of the party to spend more time with his wife and his 5 kids. He says that the strains of the election campaign were unbearably hard on the family. Now, Brian Lilly of the Toronto Sun, who had a sit-down chat with Scheer after the election, believes that to be the case as well. He said, quote, "I dropped by Scheer's office for an informal meeting when I was visiting Ottawa. The man I'd first met 15 years earlier as a young 25-year-old newly elected MP had changed a great deal, and what I sensed as he uttered those words told me more than the words themselves. Exasperation, frustration, longing, so many emotions wrapped up in one sentence." He said, quote, "We had spent the last half hour being brutally honest with each other about the election campaign and his party's performance. He heard my brutal assessment, I heard his frustrations. He told me he wanted to stay on as conservative leader and would be mounting a campaign to keep his job, but the emotion wasn't there. When I told him that I didn't see the fire in his belly to keep the job, he didn't argue with me." And Lily writes, "I've heard plenty of politicians say that they're stepping down from any given job for family reasons, and I've believed very few of them, but I believe Andrew Scheer." Now, it's pretty clear that Andrew Scheer made this decision, even though he had been informed that a poll of party members had shown that he would easily win the leadership review, the mandatory one that would take place in April of 2020 after so-called losing the election. But he also made the decision even after hiring former Harper-era Director of Communications William Stairs to act as Chief of Staff and to lead the effort to win the leadership review. So it really did come down to Scheer deciding whether to be a part-time leader or a part-time dad. Some media outlets, like Global News, have tried to claim that there was a scandal over the Conservative Party paying for part of the tuition for his kids to attend a private Catholic school in Ottawa, but several party officials, including some not keen on Scheer, have dismissed that story. And there was really no scandal because the party had agreed to pay the difference between what the Scheer family was paying in Regina versus what they were paying in Ottawa, where the family moved after he won leadership. Now, in a public statement announcing his decision to resign as leader, Scheer did not address the concerns raised by those party sources News, and his office says that the suggestion that his resignation is linked to the issue of the private school reimbursement is false. Now, in the House of Commons, when Scheer did a speech rising on a point of privilege to speak about it, he urged members to stay focused and vowed whoever wins the leadership contest will have his full support. He said, "My only ask to my fellow Conservatives is this, let's stay united." Now, speaking of unanimity, Tory MPs unanimously agreed to support Scheer as interim leader at an emergency caucus meeting on Thursday. We were told this by Conservative Caucus Chair Tom Kmyk, who mentioned this to reporters. And he was asked about the school tuition issue, and he said, "That's not what we talked about today." He later said Scheer did address some of the articles that have come out, but he did add that the main issue discussed was the party's constitution, making sure MPs do right by the membership. Now, Trudeau and other party leaders have offered brief remarks following Scheer's resignation announcement. Trudeau said, quote, "I know thoughts first and foremost are for family. I want to salute Jill Scheer and recognize his kids, who I know better than most have made significant sacrifices to see their father take on a leadership position. I very much wish him all the very, very best in his next and exciting steps, whatever they may be they here in the House or beyond. I want to thank him deeply for his service to Canada on behalf of all Canadians." Now, there was also claims that Scheer resigned over the contents of the election review being conducted by former cabinet minister John Baird. But the problem about that is that the report hasn't been written yet, and never mind being filed with the party. Baird himself says that the review process continues. He said, quote, "Some media reports this morning have falsely indicated that I've submitted my review of the 2019 campaign. My work in speaking with conservatives continues, including this week. I look forward to writing and then submitting my report when it is complete. I hope it will inform our party's next campaign and provide advice to whomever the CPC membership select as leader." So in the end, Scheer is leaving his post as leader on his own terms, despite the claims and efforts of his many high-profile detractors. And while he may not have won the election, he did serve his party well. He improved their standings and seats in the fundraising. He leaves with a record to be proud of, and now that he's made his decision, it's time for both him and the party to move on. And now the question, of course, will turn to who will run for leader. Jason Kenney has said that he wants Rona Ambrose to run while declining himself. Now, Rona Ambrose was a former cabinet minister under Stephen Harper and former interim leader just before Scheer was elected. Third place runner-up in the 2017 race, Ontario MP Aaron O'Toole has publicly stated his intention to run for leader again. And candidates could also include former PC leader Peter McKay, Quebec MP Gerard Deltel, finance critic Pierre Poilievre, and Calgary MP Michelle Rempel. But really, no one knows yet for sure exactly who's going to throw their hat into the ring, and we'll definitely have more information on this story going forward. But certainly, the fake news that's being sprouted by the media on this issue, they really should be ashamed of themselves for not being able to actually fact check further on this, because there's been so many different theories and crazy scenarios that have been coming up on social media, and it's just making it harder and harder to tell what's actually true and what isn't.
Yeah, and you know, if you go back to the golden age of journalism, when you would have the evening news anchored on the television and you would see people there reading just the news with no facts inserted, or sorry, no opinion inserted, you definitely want the facts on that, you would see an emotionless person reading the news. And the world has evolved to a point where people expect emotion out of everything that they see because it makes them feel better. But in moving away from that kind of journalism, we have lost the fact-based reporting so much so that it becomes conflated with opinion in this day and age that it's often hard to know what exactly is true and what is not. And, you know, to take this one step further, in the olden days of journalism, before you would go to press with a story, you would need a first-hand source, and you would need someone else to confirm that. Now all you need is someone to say that they might have heard something, and it's posted to Twitter straight away. And, you know, you see this on the tweets, and we have these linked in our supplementals. Sources say, and, you know, this if this was in the 1950s or the 1960s, and someone said sources say, you would think that the sources would be scared for their life or something to that effect, because back then you did not obscure the sources of your journalism unless that person's life was going to be in danger. But that's a very common practice in this day and age. Sources say, and if you look at any story out there where it says sources say, there's a good chance that it might not be true. And here at Western Context, if it says sources say, we don't trust that until other people have also been reporting on it. It's a shame it has to be that way, but that's the way it is.
Yep, it's exactly the case. And until then, we just will have to believe the official record, and until we know more about the situation, that's the way it is. And, you know, Andrew Scheer is resigning, and he's left the post after 2.5 years and increased the number of seats, won the popular vote in the election, did not gain government, but left a pretty sizable opposition left for the next party leader. And I think whoever the next party leader is will have to continue on with unity, party unity, and to make sure that the concerns held by a lot of conservative members will be heard in Ottawa. And as for the media, I think, as we've seen so many oftentimes in the last 3 years, they're just going to have to keep focusing on actually doing journalism, which seems to be a bigger struggle.
Yeah, and you know, this is going to be entirely true with the leadership race, because many people in the media think that they are free to opine on that. But it is indeed, at the end of the day, the membership of the Conservative Party that is going to choose the leader. A voter doesn't have a say unless they become a member, and the media certainly shouldn't have a say in the race as well. And, you know, the media are going to insert themselves into this race. They are going to try and sway it by running various articles against whatever candidates turn up. And we saw this when Andrew Scheer, when he became leader, our episode, The Scheer Smear. So with that being said, it's back to a restart on this, and we'll see if the media has learned or if they've gotten worse than they were. And I think, given the fact everything in this story came down to anonymous sources and nobody really knows what was being talked about, that leads us nicely into our word of the week.
Yes, our word of the week this week is fog of war. Now, this is a military term. It's known as the uncertainty in situational awareness experienced by participants in military operations. And more recently, of course, it's been put into video games where there's a fog of war where the player can't actually see what's going on. And I think the fog of war has certainly shown what's been going on this week in our news segment. Certainly, there's been a lot of uncertainty and the situational awareness surrounding Andrew Scheer's departure as leader. But, of course, there's been a lot of uncertainty and awareness on the front that is in Alberta Energy, with what's been going on there with education. Certainly, a lot of teachers have been putting out views for their school children that bear examination. And of course, there's been a lot of uncertainty in what's been going on in the forestry sector in BC. And I think that just comes down to it that in all, the economy is a bit of an uncertain state right now. So in effect, as we get to the darkest part of winter, the shortest days of the year, we do seem to be living in a bit of a fog of war right now.
And that sums up this podcast and any time else there's a major happening in the news. So we'll definitely be keeping an eye on all this. And if you want full show notes for any of these stories, visit westerncontext.ca, including the tweets or the initial story about impeachment back in January of 2017. You can also subscribe to the podcast. Any podcast listeners out there, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, you name it, westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook, where we post these shows and more at Western Context. So we'll see you guys next week for what is the last regular Western Context episode of 2019.
And we'll always make sure to look through all the stories of the week where the media may put something out and it might not be true. We'll look through everything to make sure that you get the full context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll see you next week for another episode of Western Context.